Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the distinct pleasure of having a conversation with Dr. Ian Witcher, who is full professor at the Department of Religion at the University of Manitoba. Dr. Witcher is author of a number of works, probably one of his most popular and seminal to the field is The Integrity of the Yoga Darshana, a Reconsideration of Classical Yoga. SUNY Press, the last reprint was in 2001. Ian, it's great to have you on the podcast to talk about some ideas.
Yeah, it's so nice to connect in this way with you, Raj.
It certainly is. And while the vast majority of these podcasts are geared towards probing a particular monograph reflected volume, we have had in the past podcasts from scholars such as yourself that are conversations which give us a bit more range of motion. And I think based on your interests and your experience and your perspectives, scholarly and beyond, that would be a great use of our time together. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about how you got into this field of study.
Right. Well, I was attending Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and I was enrolled in courses in political science, which I wasn't finding very interesting, and I was more attracted to other things on campus. But so eventually it kind of caught up with me, and I realized that I think I'm going to take a break from university. So I quit, and very soon after, I started meeting just a couple of people in Kingston, and before you knew it, I was practicing transcendental meditation. That was the go-to kind of thing. This is in the late 70s, actually. So Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was still on the scene. In fact, I think at one point he actually came to Kingston and did a retreat. But I started practicing TM and I started reading literature pertaining to India and Indian philosophy. And also Maharishi had done a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, so I was reading that. And then I was starting to feel that it was as if my buddhi started to awaken. And it was very, very powerful, because before it was kind of holding back, obviously. It wasn't very attracted to what was going on in the world for me. So I enrolled in after 6 months of being out of university, I enrolled in a course in the Department of Religious Studies at Queen's. There was a professor there named Clifford Hospital, who was a really good really good soul, really good scholar, and we connected. There were some other teachers there who I connected with. I took a course in mysticism. That was the first course I took. And then as I got into that course, I became more and more attracted to studying India and the religious and philosophical thought of India. So it sort of took off from there. So I ended up doing an honors degree there. I maintained my practice of meditation throughout. And then eventually, after getting an honors degree, spent some time outside of university doing some work and so on and so forth, paying off student loan. I met my wife-to-be Rose at Queen's, and then eventually we moved to Ottawa and started working there. And I then met a teacher from India who was traveling through Canada, who was quite a renowned guru figure, certainly in Canada. He was known mostly by Canadians. His name was Swami Sham. And Swami Sham resided in the Kulu Valley in Himachal Pradesh. But he was on one of these tours of Canada at the time, and I met him in Montreal, actually, through one of his MA students, who I had connected with just previously to that. So this is in 1981. So I was quite inspired by Swami Sham, and then eventually in 1983 went over to India and spent some time in his ashram. And his approach was very yoga Vedanta, you know, that combination. Advaita, but in a reinterpretation of Advaita that was all about transforming the vehicle rather than just transcending, also transforming the vehicle of the mind and body. And so in that sense, it was somewhat tantric without being tantric, if you know what I mean. And he was a very profound speaker, a great communicator. His English was fantastic. We were all very lucky. And there were about 150 or so Canadian, mostly Canadians, some Europeans, and some from India who would come be on his ashram. Many of them were living there. So after a while there, I felt that I'd had my fill for that time. And then I also, on that trip, though, I should mention, on my way to India, I had a very profound experience with Jay Krishnamurti, who was giving a talk in Switzerland. Now that I mentioned Krishnamurti, I actually did a BA thesis on him at Queen's. I was able to do that. So Krishnamurti was someone who just came into my life. And I ended up doing a BA thesis on him because at Queen's you were asked to do a thesis in your honors degree. And then I thought, oh, I really want to meet this guy. And it so happened that he was giving a set of talks in Sanin, Switzerland, which he did every year. And my wife and I went through there. We had relatives in Switzerland. So we went through and I heard some of his talks and actually met him after a talk, walking along a little mountain path that he would do between Gstaad and Sanin. So after one of his talks, I ran after him and just introduced myself. And then we just walked together for a little while, and he took my hand, and I had a very powerful kind of, I don't know if I'd call it awakening, but it was just a sense of clarity that came over me just through that. When he looked into my eyes and took my hand, and then I just said goodbye, and that was it. He passed away about 3 years later, by the way, in 1986, Krishnamurti. So Krishnamurti was a very powerful influence, and I really took to his writings. And of course, what his writings do is they create a real sense of a tension between tradition and spiritual awareness. Because Krishnamurti was saying, don't trust tradition, don't trust a guru, don't follow another. And at the same time, he obviously felt he had something to say or he wouldn't be saying it. But his whole approach was in some ways quite revolutionary, where he wanted to throw back onto his listeners the opportunity and from his perspective, the necessity to awaken in the way he was talking, what he was saying. He wanted people to actually have this tacit recognition in the moment. It was a very direct approach, which in many ways was ahead of its time, I think, for a lot of people. A kind of what you might call a direct path to spiritual awakening through understanding the movement of one's own mind in the present moment. So it was very yogic at the same time, which I just found that I just took to it. And the more I got into the studies after all this through Swami Shyam. Swami Shyam was very supportive of me doing work in university because he felt that would help to bring a credibility to being able to articulate Patanjali and live it for many educated people. You know, maybe if the idea being that certainly within tradition, study was a major part of yoga, swadhyaya, self-study, study, applying the mind, harnessing the mind, using the mind in an aklisht manner, a helpful manner, in a non-afflicted manner, in a manner that opens the mind up rather than just merely throws more layers of knowledge. It's opening the mind up to something that is present within it. I'll put it that way. And so just as I'm talking to you now, I'm beginning to see that the Krishnamurti approach was very direct, but it was also in many ways aligned with Patanjali's wonderful classical teaching. The way he defines yoga as yogas chitta vritti nirodha is it's a kind of cessation of the mind and its functioning, whereby the true nature of ourself is not known, and therefore there has to be this kind of cessation of this veiling over our true nature. And that became my main study for the next 10-15 years in my own meditation. And I thank Swami Shyam for actually being very inspirational. And Swami Shyam's approach was realize it for yourself and apply your mind. Study, awaken, articulate for others what this meaning is for chitta vritti nirodha, because it's as if the whole tradition was in those four Sanskrit words. Chitta vritti nirodha. Which we could talk a little bit more about later, because I think that more folks need to know the tremendous teaching that's been going on long time ago in Sankhya and in yoga, in the classical yoga tradition, about being educated into what our mind really is, what the chitta really is. And it seems to me that without using this kind of terminology, this is exactly what Krishnamurti was doing in his approach, although he was much more direct. He didn't want to give out a series of practices because he didn't feel you can't practice awareness. You can only be aware. And there's a tension there in spiritual discipline between practice and awakening. So in other words, that became a really important aspect I was trying to deal with in my own life, right? And as tedious at times as it can be, to really get into the nitty-gritty of being a scholar, I began to realize that what I was picking away at was just the kind of joining the dots I needed to join to make sense of this, my own calling, as it were, both as a scholar and practitioner. And I saw at the end of the day, there's absolutely no division between them. We create these dualities. Whatever you do in life, it can simply be an activity of your own being. So there need not be a conflict. Although, as you know, I'm sure, Raj, there is a tremendous amount of discipline needed in order to, for example, write a PhD dissertation on some topic that we're inspired to do, and knowing the literature and relating to it critically. However, at the end of the day, I'm grateful for having followed through on all this scholarship and continued it, and have since as a career, but all along as the practitioner, as the meditator, being able to appreciate the tradition, especially within Hinduism, because that's more that I know, Hinduism rather than Buddhism, although the two are very closely aligned in many ways. And so I went on and did an MA at Concordia with a professor named David Miller, who had done work in Hinduism. And then eventually I went on and did a PhD at Cambridge with Dr. Julius Lipner, who was a fantastic person to do this kind of work on, and he encouraged me to do Patanjali. I dabbled in Ramanuja Shankara, and then I began to realize that it's really Patanjali that I wanted to do a dissertation on. So I ended up doing some work at Cambridge after the dissertation. This would be in 1990. After 1992, I ended up getting some teaching, though, at U of A, University of Alberta. And my wife was doing a dissertation in education there. So for about 3 years, I taught there. And then I went back to Cambridge and was assigned a role to help to administer a research institute, which had a five-year tenure to it. And I did that with Julius Lipner, and we ended up doing conferences at Cambridge on yoga a lot and on the Hindu tradition. And I managed to do lots of publishing and writing and research there. And then eventually I came back to Canada in 2000 to U of M and got Klaus Klostermeyer's old position, where Professor Klostermeyer had been for many years. So that's a little background.
It's always about the scenic route, and in sharing your experiences, you've actually preempted and addressed a number of my subsequent questions, which is both enjoyable and an efficient way to do it. But one point that I would like to resurface that I feel is important is the tension, or perhaps perceived tension, between the scholarly and the spiritual mode of inquiry or experience. The extent to which critical thinking geared at empirical reality through the scientific method is a different mode of experience versus introspection into being itself and the states of consciousness and experiences that avail themselves, that are perhaps innately subjective and beyond the mode of empirical inquiry. This isn't, I'm not taking a position. I'm raising this as a common tension that is faced, as certainly in particular among scholars who may not be practitioners and practitioners who may not be interested in scholarship. And so I'd love for you to say a little more about this from your perspective.
Yes. Well, having really gotten into this through an inner kind of awakening. I mean, something just said, it's time to wake up. And then I was drawn to the study more. The tension, I think, is very real in people who got into meditation. Maybe you started following a teacher, whether from India or not. And why bother to go to university when you can get the real deal through a teacher, right? And I think a lot of people naively let go of their connections to further education in a formal way, thinking that the pursuit or the search for self-realization or spiritual liberation was the only thing to do. And the tension that brought up in me was, yes, that was my main urge, mumukshutva, you know? But at the same time, it could include study. It could include analysis. It could include a critical investigation of literature, because what I began to see was I'm really studying the history of consciousness, of how things unfold, and you get the opportunity to understand and appreciate the various conditions through which people have, whether they're spiritual teachers in India at whatever time, the various conditions that people are working through, and then the claim towards self-realization, for example, spiritual liberation, moksha, for example, in India, one of the great aims of life, purusharthas. This sense that spiritual liberation. So the question was, what is enlightenment? I mean, this is the question that came. What is enlightenment? And the more I got into it, the more I began to see that tension started to dissolve, because it became more and more an inclusive investigation into everything, a curiosity about everything in life. And so it became not so much some system that was in opposition to when I sat down to meditate, but rather through meditation, through allowing myself to sink into a, for lack of a better expression, deeper space within. By allowing that to happen, the tension between being a scholar and a meditator, it didn't make any sense. It became a creative tension rather than an oppositional tension. And so creativity then, how to be creative with what one's studying. In other words, as a meditator, from within, you are motivated to do a certain study, but then you begin to realize that you're including yourself in this study, that the Patanjali that Witcher was studying was really Patanjali plus Witcher. But that's okay, because that's what I think Patanjali would want. I mean, you see, we have to include ourselves. And, you know, in some ways, that's what it became. And so the tensions started to dissolve. And through my own experiential understanding, I was able to be very curious about all kinds of things. And ecstatically curious, actually. Ecstatically curious. There was nothing so much holding me down. And I'm grateful for having discovered religious studies, because the whole gamut of history is there, philosophy is there, sociological dynamics, psychology is there. So it all came together for me. And simply, when I look at these four Sanskrit words, yoga, citta, vritti, nirodha, it's all there. There's nothing that I do not see. I cannot see anything that does not include in life, including our human relationships and so on.
It's a fascinating perspective. It seems to me that the tension in my personal perspective and experience, particularly at the academy, is very much alive and well, manifest in conversations, manifest in education of undergraduate students, the kinds of education they're looking for and receiving, the kinds that are made available to them or even possible at the academy. So it's very much attention. At the same time, in my view, ultimately scholarship and spirituality mutually complement and inform each other in a certain way. One thing that comes to mind as I hear you speak is that it's clear to me that you are a seeker first, who is also a scholar, such that scholarship is the tool and the seeking is the hand. And from that perspective, arguably, one can, from a spiritual perspective, one can flow into the space of whatever other paradigm one is using. But for one who is situated in the universe, such that scholarship is how they wake up and go to bed, and that intellectual computational mind is the hand, then it becomes difficult to integrate the two from that perspective, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But onto more interesting things. What is it, if you could probably crudely generalize or at least point or indicate, what is it that you hope to accomplish in your scholarly campaign? What is it that you're trying to show or change or do? And just to give you a sense, what I'll ask next is sort of your thought on yoga and what you think the yoga world needs today. And so you can kind of parse that out however you'd like.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it'd be great to from now, for example, I'm doing these remote classes, right? And there's one on Indian philosophy. I do Intro to Hinduism. Guru Disciple is another course I do. And then some advanced studies in Hinduism, where I bring up themes often pertaining to spiritual liberation and the question of enlightenment, as it were. Spiritual liberation, what does it mean? And the relationship between consciousness and the body, mind, self. And so the relevance of all this stuff, you know, bringing out the relevance of just, for example, a teaching on yoga. I mean, Patanjali basically said, all right, yoga is citta vritti nirodha. And then when that cessation of mistaken identity takes place, then the self abides in its true nature, true form. And then he took the rest of the Yoga Sutras to basically flesh out what those two sutras mean and the implications and what goes on in the process of that Nirodha, because Nirodha is both a process and it's also a resolution. It's a process of bringing about clarity, and yet it is then a resolution of any tensions from within. And the resolution of those tensions is an ongoing kind of process in the sense that you can awaken to the space of liberation within, but then the body mind needs to be aligned with that, you see, and so that it's really a question then of recognizing something from deeply within and allowing that to almost colonize the body mind, you know, including our thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, and certainly into our behavior. And living in a much more non-afflicted mode of activity. And it seems to me that the teaching in yoga, classically, everyone likes the word yoga, you know, in a sense, there can be a yoga for so many things. But for me, what I'd like to do is bring out this sense of a yoga of the whole, rather than a this yoga or a that yoga, a yoga of the whole, and that is realizing our true nature as it were, one with the whole, you know, a yoga of the whole that includes the knowledge component of jnana. It includes the action component of karma. It includes the heart component, the bhakti, loving devotion. It's all part of our nature as human beings. These the dynamic of knowledge, love. We're emotional beings, we're physical beings, we're sexual beings, and so on and so forth. So articulating the integrity, as I said in my first book, the real integrity of the Yoga Darshana is that it finally allows us to embody our true form. Whereas, as you know, in a lot of the literature, a lot of the interpretation, it was about severing consciousness from associating with form. And what I saw was it's very tempting, but it's a mistake to simply conflate our prakriti, nature, the universe, the world, manifestation with spiritual ignorance. That is a profound mistake, to simply conflate embodiment with having to do more with the nature of spiritual ignorance than with almost a kind of deeply rooted intention springing from consciousness itself to embody more of itself. And that is what I feel Patanjali opens one into, without going into all the labels of what that freedom is. He opens one into the freedom and lets the experience speak for itself. So I would like to be able to bring the integrity of this great scripture out more. And it's all there, just it has been so much labeled dualistic, a dualistic system. And I think at a great expense, because it is a holistic system. So I would call it a yoga of the whole, that the chittavritti nirodha, the yoga is a yoga of the whole. The totality of consciousness and existence is all there, and we just need to get it right, you know.
What would you say, Ian, to one who would say, "Hey, you know, I took a really interesting intro Hinduism course, so I watched his talk, and I remember that yoga is a darshana that's related to Sankhya and this idea that Purusha and Prakriti," you know, say an interlocutor said to you, "Well, wait a minute, isn't this about, isn't yoga actually etymologically related to the idea of separating because of this Sankhya idea of, well, Purusha and Prakriti need to become unalloyed and therein lies freedom?" And if that's the case, then what do you mean? What would you say to that?
Yeah, well, there is the need for discernment. So in a sense, discernment separates our profound habit in human consciousness of confusing ourselves for a kind of form identity at the expense of realizing our essential identity. And so there is the need then to separate, right, the awareness from that confusion, from that mistaking ourselves for that. So there's an epistemic cleaning up, as it were. And so I would say the separation is not a metaphysical separation so much as an epistemological awareness that starts coming through. So in other words, the V-yoga Yoga Viyoga. Bhoja Raja was famous for citing that in his commentary. The separation is a necessary part of the process. In other words, even Aurobindo said that Purusha must be separated from its confusion with misidentifying itself with Prakriti, and then Purusha is liberated, and also Prakriti is liberated. We liberate Prakriti through yoga. Even Sankhya says that. The Sankhya system says at the end of the day, it isn't Purusha that's liberated, it is Prakriti that is liberated. So we're liberating the body-mind from trying to be the self. We're liberating the sense of self as being a product of the seen, using Patanjali's language. We're separating our true awareness from all that confusion or mistaken identity. So there is that need to separate. And then there is awareness doing its thing. Then there is awareness doing its thing. And that awareness is a power of consciousness, a chitti shakti. Yeah.
So let's typically keep on the level at sort of the naive interlocutor. But I just want to dive down. I can't resist diving down into this idea that you present that through liberation, Purusha is liberated and Prakriti or material nature is also liberated. And in particular, what you just said about liberating the mind from being or wanting to be the self. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah. So it isn't the true nature of the mind to be the self. That is why we suffer. So the chitta, going back to the terminology in the yoga philosophy, the chitta is really it's an umbrella term which includes our buddhi, our intelligence factor. It includes our ordinary sense of self, ahamkara, and it includes the manas, through which our senses function. So the chitta is this, the mode through which consciousness functions. So it's the functioning of consciousness. And that chitta then is not the essence of consciousness by any means, but it is how consciousness functions. And it through which form is experienced, form, phenomena, and so on. Subject-object kind of relationship is enabled to be part of our experiential world. Now, the problem is that consciousness, insofar as it has taken a body-mind, whether it's Raj or Ian, then starts to exclusively identify with itself as form, such as I was born and so on at a certain time, my name is Ian, and all the conditioning. So the sense of self takes on all these limitations, all these conditions, our form identity, and it's important to qualify that that's all right to have form identity. But to be exclusively identified with form sets us up for always, as it were, being dissatisfied. Because what we're truly seeking is we're truly seeking an innate sense of happiness of our being, which is never outside of ourself. So the problem with chitta is that the activity of being a self is mistaken for our true self. And that is usually called ego consciousness. And so the ahamkara then has been often reduced to a sense of a separate self that functions through the chitta. In other words, we mistake an activity of consciousness, a functioning of consciousness, as being an entity that I call I. And that chitta is not meant to carry an entity called I. And therefore, that entity called I, not being our true nature, suffers because of its lack of knowing its true nature. And that is what it seeks. The whole path of seeking is to seek that intrinsic state of being, which is happiness itself, which is pure conscious being. And the only way to do that is to rest in that being. It's not something you can attain. So the citta is given this role whereby it's stuck with a sense of self functioning, as it were, mistaking itself as an entity, whereas it is really an activity. So that mind really gets sick and tired of trying to be the self. In fact, its true nature is pure sattva. The true nature of the citta is a pure sattva in the form of buddhi. And that is what we need to reawaken to through yoga. So one of the greatest teachings of Patanjali is to reawaken our true buddhi, our true intelligence, for lack of a better word, our true intellect, which enables us to sink into our true being through that process and realize that we always were that being. So we're liberating the citta from being the self. And I think going back to Patanjali's terminology, we are no longer mistaking ourself for being of the nature of what we can see, because that which is citta can be seen by awareness.
It's fascinating.
Our personality then is fine. It's all fine. The problem is often we throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, oh, there must be the cessation of that citta, like an ontological cessation, as if vrittis can't function in the awakened state. Whereas vrittis can function, but one is no longer mistaking oneself for the nature and form of thought, feeling, emotion, perception, and so on. So you liberate all of that from this ignorance of our true nature. And that liberates Prakriti to flow in her true being. And that has all kinds of implications for today. I think I can get really excited about that, Raj. It touches on all kinds of issues that need to be liberated. You know, we need to liberate the feminine. We need to liberate the masculine. We need to liberate our Mother Earth from all this the ecological hardships she's been that have been thrust upon her. It's all there as part of Prakriti, and so I think yoga has this really profound capacity to touch on all these subjects. And people will do that. It will be an aha moment for them to realize this. It's by realizing this from within that there is really nothing without that is separate from what one is realizing within. And therefore, one becomes super connected. The experiential realm doesn't blind us from our true selves. It becomes a mode through which the activity of awakening can play itself out, rather than merely the activity of a lack of awakening in life.
That's fascinating. And given the time, I think that's the perfect place to stop. Rather than descend into the minutiae, let's leave the audience with this expansive idea about mistaking becoming for being. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast and chatting with me today.
Well, you're welcome. I really enjoyed it. And I think doing these sorts of things, Raj, is a real service to others. And, you know, it's seems to be part and parcel of the times. Podcasts are good. It's all very, very good. Yes.
Keeps me out of trouble, I suppose, or at least from collecting dust. And I joke that amped up production of podcasts in 2020 as sort of my contribution to the war effort, because people need content, they're stuck at home, and this this is something I can help with at least. So we'll have to have you back. I think there's so much in what you said that could well occupy another podcast. We'll have you back if you're up for it.
Yeah, it's a little glimpse into
yeah, absolutely.
More things.
We'll have you back. For those of you listening, you've just heard part one of a conversation with Dr. Ian Witcher, who is a professor at the Department of Religion at the University of Manitoba in this country called Canada, for those of you who may not realize. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the relationship between being and becoming.